The United States says the Biden administration will seek to secure $100 million in funding for a UN mission to Haiti.
The United States stands ready to support that mission by providing robust financial and logistical assistance.
Plus, now that thousands of ethnic Armenians have fled Nagorno-Karabakh, what does it mean for the region?
If all 120,000 ethnic Armenians go down the Lachin Corridor to Armenia, the small country could face a humanitarian crisis.
And emergency services worldwide are racing to recruit thousands of new volunteers ahead of the next wildfire season. Today is Tuesday, September 26th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good morning. I'm Steve Miller. The United States and Kenya signed a defense agreement on Monday aimed at strengthening counterterrorism efforts in East Africa and supporting Kenya's efforts to take the lead in the security mission to Haiti. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin and Kenya's Defense Minister Aden Duale signed the five-year agreement on Monday in the Kenyan capital of Nairobi.
The United States stands ready to support that mission by providing robust financial and logistical assistance. And we intend to work with the United States Congress to provide up to $100 million in support.
Austin urged other nations to follow Kenya's example and provide more personnel, equipment, support, training, and funding for the planned multinational security mission to Haiti. Kenya has pledged to send 1,000 security officers to Haiti to counter gang violence that has surged since the July 2021 assassination of Haitian President Jovenel Moïse. The security mission, however, has yet to be approved by the UN Security Council. In New York, a judge has questions for former President Donald Trump's lawyers in a business fraud lawsuit against him. From the Associated Press, Ed Donahue reports.
Trump's lawyers want Judge Arthur Engoron to throw out the lawsuit. The charges are deceiving banks, insurers, and others by exaggerating Donald Trump's wealth by as much as $3 billion. At times, the judge argued with Trump attorney Christopher Keis. In one back and forth, the judge pounded his fist on top of his bench, saying, "You cannot make false statements." There were questions for the state's prosecutor as well, but the tone was less combative. The hearing ended without any rulings. Arguments will resume next week. The former president's trial in New York could start as soon as October 2nd. I'm Ed Donahue.
We're also following these other stories from around the world. The United States on Monday said it refused a request by Iran's foreign minister to visit Washington last week, pointing to concerns about Tehran's record, including past detentions of U.S. citizens. Iran last week, however, allowed five U.S. citizens to leave in a prisoner swap, in which the United States also arranged the transfer of $6 billion in frozen Iranian funds from South Korea to an account in Qatar. Kosovo was observing a day of mourning on Monday following the death of a Kosovar Albanian police officer that was killed by Serbian gunmen who then barricaded themselves at an Orthodox monastery north of the capital. It was not immediately clear who supports the approximately 30 gunmen who were dressed in combat uniforms when they used an armored vehicle to storm the monastery. Most of the gunmen were able to escape the monastery on Sunday evening, but at least three of them were killed and six arrested. Thousands of ethnic Armenians fled the breakaway region of Nagorno-Karabakh on Monday, queuing for fuel and jamming the road to Armenia after their decades-old separatist state was defeated by Azerbaijan in a lightning-fast military operation. What's going on, and what does it mean for the wider region? Reuters' Olivia Chan brings us that story.
The leadership of the breakaway region says 120,000 ethnic Armenians will leave Nagorno-Karabakh as they do not want to live as part of Azerbaijan. Baku says it will guarantee their rights and integrate the region. But the Armenians say they fear repression and ethnic cleansing. Azerbaijan has denied any such intentions. In the first Karabakh War between 1988 and 1994, About 30,000 people were killed and more than a million people displaced. If all 120,000 ethnic Armenians go down the Lachin corridor to Armenia, the small country could face a humanitarian crisis. Armenian Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan said on Friday that space had been allocated for at least 40,000 people. With winter approaching, it was not immediately clear where 120,000 people could be housed in Armenia, whose population is just 2.8 million. The International Committee of the Red Cross says it has started registering people looking for unaccompanied children or who have lost contact with loved ones. For Azerbaijan, the exit of Armenians from Karabakh is a major victory. It brings an apparent close to many years of war and squabbling over the region. President Ilham Aliyev said his iron fist had consigned the idea of an independent ethnic Armenian Karabakh to history and claims that the region will become a paradise as part of Azerbaijan. The mass exodus could change the delicate balance of power in the South Caucasus region. It is an area with a patchwork of ethnicities crisscrossed with oil and gas pipelines. Russia, the United States, Turkey, and Iran are all fighting for influence. Russia has a military base in Armenia and regards itself as the prime security guarantor in the region. But Armenia's Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan has said the crisis showed that his country could not rely on Russia to defend its interests. Pashinyan said that unidentified forces were seeking to stoke a coup against him. He has accused Russian media of fighting an information war against him. Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov said on Monday that Russia considers Armenia its ally, but rejects Yerevan's attempts to blame Moscow for the crisis. This month, Armenia hosted a joint army exercise with the United States, which has criticized Azerbaijan's military operation. Turkey, a NATO member, supports Azerbaijan.
Olivia Chan of Reuters News. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Ukrainian officials say that the missile that blasted the Crimean headquarters of Russia's Navy last week killed 34 officers, including the fleet commander. Ukraine has provided no evidence to support that claim, and VOA has been unable to independently verify the assertion. The claims, however, are vastly different from what Russia has been reporting. Russia's military announced the attack on the building and initially said one serviceman was killed, but later said the person was not killed, but missing. Elsewhere, Ukrainian and European officials have taken another step toward the creation of an international compensation mechanism for registering evidence and claims for damage, loss, or injury caused to people, businesses, infrastructure, and the environment due to Russia's aggression in Ukraine. Lori London spoke with Irina Mudra, Ukraine's Deputy Minister of Justice, on the ongoing efforts for reparation.
In a month and a half, it will be 1 year since the UNGAR adopted the resolution and formally recognized that Russia must pay war reparations to Ukraine by creating an international compensation mechanism for the damage caused by this full-scale invasion. And today we already have the first element of this comprehensive compensation mechanism, which was proposed by Ukraine and supported by international world community. The International Register of Damage has been created by the enlarged partial agreement under the auspices of Council of Europe. The register will serve as a record in documentary form of evidences and claims information on damage, loss, and injury caused in the territory of Ukraine by the Russian Federation's internationally wrongful acts in or against Ukraine. To date, 43 states and the European Union are the parties to the register. In addition to European countries, the United States and Japan and Canada are already members of this register. Negotiations to involve other countries from all continents into the International Register of Damage are underway. And on the fields of this high-level week at the United Nations, I held a couple of bilateral meetings to encourage states from Global South to join this register.
Once these people are registered, these states, what does that mean?
The register serves as a database, as a record of all eligible claims for compensation of damage, loss, and injury, as well as the evidences underlying such claims. It will provide a platform into which the claimants in Ukraine can submit their claims and evidences and will verify that the claims are eligible for inclusion into the register based on three main criteria. Damage must have occurred in the territory of Ukraine on or after 24th of February 2022, and it must be linked with the Russian aggression. So the register is called upon to receive and process information on claims of damage and evidence, categorize, classify, and organize such claims, assess and determine the eligibility of these claims, and record the eligible claims for the purposes of their future examination and adjudication. But the register will not adjudicate the claims itself, will not make the assessment of the amount of compensation to be paid. This will be done by a claims commission, which is envisaged to be the next step.
Any idea of the estimated amount of losses that have been incurred so far from Russia's invasion? Or will this be an ongoing process as more losses are incurred?
Starting from the 24th of February, Ukraine is facing with its most serious challenges since the achieving of independence in 1991. And the ongoing war has already resulted in significant loss of life, unprecedented damages and losses. According to Ukraine, rapid damage and needs assessment made jointly by the World Bank and the government of Ukraine and European Union, as of February 2023, reconstruction and recovery needs of Ukraine are estimated about $411 billion. Pursuant to the latest assessment made by the Kyiv School of Economics as of June 2023, the total amount of direct damage to Ukraine's infrastructure caused to the war exceeded $150 billion. Of the total direct damage, the largest share is the loss of houses, nearly $60 billion, including $1 billion in damage from flooding and destruction of residential buildings. And in 2023, Ukraine already needs $14.1 billion for priority reconstruction and recovery investments, rebuilding infrastructure, which was heavily damaged by Russia, housing and transportation, economic development of communities, job creation, business opportunities in the liberated areas.
It will support individuals, companies, farmers, the government, infrastructure, and I'm assuming also environmental destruction, such as the Kakhovka Dam situation?
Yeah, more than 2,500 cases of environmental damage caused by Russian aggression has already been recorded. And the Prosecutor General's office is investigated 14 cases of ecocide. The detonation of Kakhovka hydroelectric power station on the 6th of June 2023 was the most grievous international crime of ecocide and environmental weapon of mass destruction since the start of this full-scale invasion of Ukraine. As a result, more than 40 towns and villages and one of the world's most valuable agricultural regions were destroyed. And the number of ecosystems destroyed or pushed to the brink of extinction is measured in thousands.
That's Ukraine's Deputy Minister of Justice, Irina Mudra, speaking to our own Lori London. And you can hear the entire conversation and more updates on the war in Ukraine in our podcast, Flashpoint Ukraine. Emergency services worldwide are racing to recruit thousands of new volunteers to replace an aging frontline force ahead of the next wildfire season. Authorities are targeting women, migrants, and students in a field traditionally dominated by older men. Phil Mercer takes it from here.
As summers get hotter and drier, wildfire seasons start earlier and last longer.
On a total fire ban day, fire permits are suspended. There are restrictions on things like welding. And if you're
a record spell of September heat has prompted severe bushfire alerts this week in southeastern Australia. Authorities can impose a total fire ban. This forbids the use of a fire out in the open, at, for example, campsites or the beach. Fighting fires in Australia and many other countries relies heavily on volunteers. There are almost 200,000 volunteers across the 8 state and territory bushfire services. New South Wales has the world's largest fire brigade. But Commissioner Rob Rogers told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation that it urgently needs new members.
By and large, it's still an ageing demographic, so I think our average age is in the 50s now. I do get concerned that there's not enough people coming in to replace them.
Australia is one of the world's most multicultural countries. A quarter of the population was born overseas, and emergency authorities want their firefighting services to better reflect the communities they serve. Sara Azadegan is a recent recruit in South Australia's volunteer firefighting force. She told local media that her brigade is becoming far more diverse.
It will be daunting at first. There's a lot of acronyms and a lot of things to get to know. We've got different races of people, like different nationalities, lesbian women. We've got gay men, and we've had the youngest members who are about 18. And we've got an active firefighter who's like in his late 70s.
Other fire-prone countries are also battling to find new recruits. Canada has its worst ever wildfire season, but recruiting volunteers is difficult. The work can be physically demanding. In the province of Alberta, a field fitness test for some support positions requires applicants to walk more than 3 kilometres with an 11.4-kilogram pack in 30 minutes or less. This year's record fires have resulted in Canada deploying around 550 military personnel and more than 1,700 international firefighters, paid for by the provinces to help its overworked crews. Recent fires in southern Europe have also prompted officials to bolster firefighting resources. In Greece, the Minister of Climate Crisis and Civil Protection, Vasilis Kikilias, told local media that the priority was the recruitment of more than 500 new firefighters who will strengthen our forces during wildfires. Large wildfires were once rare in the United Kingdom, but authorities have been investing in new off-road vehicles, drones and backpack sprayers to prepare for hotter summers. UK firefighters have also travelled to Spain for wildfire training. Phil Mercer, VOA News, Sydney.
And finally, in Portland, Maine, Linus Manchester visited with Aaron Pelletier, the executive director of the Gulf of Maine Lobster Foundation. The organization collaborates with local lobstermen to remove abandoned fishing gear from the ocean. Pelletier believes anything that doesn't belong in the sea should be removed, and her organization's Gear Grab program focuses on cleaning up the waters.
If we drained the ocean, I think people would be shocked to see what's down there.
Fishermen are stewards of the environment, and they want to protect the fishing grounds that they make a living on. But with fishing gear, unfortunately, some of the risks are that it can get lost or cut off by other recreational boaters, or storms can take it. I think that anything that doesn't belong in the ocean shouldn't be in the ocean. So when we started cleaning up marine debris out of the ocean, it was right up my alley. Gear Grab is one of our projects that kind of encompasses a bunch of different aspects of cleaning up derelict fishing gear or ghost gear. Anything that we can give back to the fishermen, we do. And then if it is in a condition where it's, you know, they don't want it anymore, it's just too old or mangled up, then we kind of upcycle it, if you will, and recycle it as much as possible. We've been in the range of 3 to 4 tons of a mass that we can find and bring to the surface. The biggest one we've ever done is 7 tons. We're targeting those big balls of gear because they're actually accumulating more ghost gear by rolling around on the bottom. They're like a big snowball. And so if there's some gear here and some gear there, they're just going to get entangled in it, and it's going to grow over time. Our gear grab program started around 2011, and Jim actually participated in that one of the first years that we started doing that. He obviously seems very, very interested in this project and helping out, because he's always out there on the water and he's always calling me with ideas.
When Aaron started making it possible for us to actually do something and dispose of it properly, it meant that I could sort of combine my abilities and experience diving and lobstering with, you know, something that was actually worth doing. The fishing gear is designed to catch and kill marine animals. But busted up fenders, dock lines, plastic bottles and stuff, those weren't designed to kill animals, but they do just as efficiently, right? And they don't deteriorate at all. Our problem is a public education, really.
I think that people need to really start understanding their impact. What's affecting the ocean negatively that we can change about the way we live? My hope is that, you know, a project like this is what kind of educates people and makes them more aware of what they can do. 3/4 of this planet is the ocean, and so we really need to work together to keep it healthy.
And that'll do it for us today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, we thank you for listening. For pictures, video stories, and more, be sure to follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In mid-September, USAID, the government of Norway, and the World Economic Forum hosted an event on the sidelines of the United Nations General Assembly to discuss how best to help finance Africa's agricultural growth and find new ways to better support those involved in growing, processing, and selling the food that consumers eat. The agriculture sector employs 2/3 of Africa's workforce. Yet this fast-growing continent, which is expected to account for 1/4 of the world's population by 2050, still does not grow enough food to feed its people, as outlined by the United Nations' second Sustainable Development Goal, Zero Hunger. The elimination of hunger is one of the main objectives of the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID. We're very, very focused on improving access for smallholder farmers in particular, who produce the majority of food on the continent of Africa, on helping them access more inputs, said Isabel Coleman, Deputy Administrator for Policy and Programming at USAID.
Seeds, fertilizer, financing. Tonight's event was about increasing access to financing, not in a micro sense, but in a bigger sense.
These are agricultural businesses who are beyond the need for microfinancing, but who are not big enough to work with many major banks. Financiers think of investing in agriculture in Africa as very risky, said Isabel Coleman. This is why USAID launched the Financing for Agricultural Small and Medium Enterprises in Africa Fund, which has the potential to support 500 agri-SMEs and 1.5 million smallholder farmers. It is intended to help de-risk the process for investors, to help by putting in grant money, plus some grant money from the government of Norway, said Deputy Administrator Coleman. Our goal is to start with $70 million, but get to at least $200 million.
If a company runs into trouble, that donor money will be the first loss. We'll take the loss first, so it helps companies that are going to be making bigger investments, leveraging that private sector capital, say, okay, well, they're going to take the first loss, so it de-risks the investment for them. And we hope that this will really surge in additional financing.
We're really trying to find $1 billion of funding to be able to help some smallholder farmers really grow their businesses, to have a significant impact on systems and value chains in agriculture in Africa over the coming years.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.